You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Love, courage, truth. Glenn Beck.
Vulnerable. Entitlement. Diversity. Transgender. Fetus. Evidence-based. Science-based. These are the seven words that the Trump administration reportedly has banned the CDC from using in its 2019 budget proposals. If this is true, it's a clear attempt to target progressive causes and an early Christmas present for those who are hungry for red meat. After the report on the ban was published by the Washington Post, the CDC's director insisted there are no banned words at the CDC and we're going to continue to talk about all the important health programs for the public. But the damage was already done. Everyone on the left is outraged by the supposed ban. Those on the left don't like it when words are banned? Wow, I have to say, I understand your feeling. I'm never happy when any words are banned. If this was the Trump administration's way of depoliticizing the CDC, kind of backfired there. Just make Republicans look like they hate science and trans people and, you know, all of that garbage. Here's what I think. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, should stick to controlling and preventing disease. That's it. Their budget of $7 billion should go all of it, every dime, to that and nothing else. Another idea for you, just stick to the blueprint. There is no need to ban any more words.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine introduced me via YouTube to a guy named Jordan Burnt Peterson. He is a clinical psychologist and cultural critic and professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. He's a man that apparently makes a lot of people angry, at least those who are progressives and diehards on the left. We're pleased to have him on with us now. Professor, how are you, sir?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm a new fan of yours. And quite honestly, one of the most remarkable things I've heard you say, at least on a YouTube clip, you were asked the question about whether you believed in the resurrection. And I thought it was such a thoughtful answer and such a brave answer that I became an immediate fan. Do you remember your answer?
I don't remember that. I don't remember the specific answer that you're referring to, so I'm afraid I can't comment on it further, but I'm glad that you found it useful. I mean, it's a very difficult question, obviously.
Can you answer it now? I'd like to see where you stand today, if it's the same place.
Well, most of what I've been doing, I've done a 15-part lecture series online on the Bible, right? But I've been approaching it psychologically. Which is not to say that it can't be approached religiously or theologically or as literature in many different ways, but I've been approaching it psychologically. And there's a deep psychological idea behind the symbol of the resurrection, which is obviously an extraordinarily powerful idea. It's gripped billions of people for thousands of years. It's an overwhelmingly powerful idea. And the psychological idea is that in order for human beings to be redeemed, in order for our psyches to be renewed, we have to be willing to let that part of us that's unworthy die so that a better part can come to life. And you experience this every time you encounter a serious setback in life. You know, if you're betrayed by someone or if you make a catastrophic error, you have to go through your past life with a fine-tooth comb and your assumptions and your axioms, and you have to find out which ones have served you badly and which need to be cast into the fire, so to speak. And that's very, very painful. It's something that's very hard for people to do, because the part of you that's made a mistake is alive, and it doesn't want to be destroyed and revivified. But it's something that you need to continually engage in as you move through life in order to stay on top of the ever-changing environment. It's like, you know, a forest has to be renewed by fire, and the fire strips out the old growth and the dead wood, but it lets new things come to life. And at minimum, from a psychological perspective, the idea of the resurrection portrays that fundamental reality. Now, it's the reality of being willing to let your old self die so that your new self, your new better self, can come into being, which is a particularly useful thing to think about around New Year's, right? Because that's something we dramatize at New Year's, with the death of the old year and the rebirth of the new year. That's associated as well, obviously, with the idea of Christmas and the dawn of something new and redemptive. So I don't know if that was the same answer.
It wasn't. It wasn't. That was a good one. It wasn't. I'll let others find your talk on that. And but it was a great answer. That was a good answer as well. I really wanted to talk to you because you have you've led an interesting life, and the path that you have taken after you finished school, you went over to Europe for about a year. And you decided to, you were moved by the fear of the Cold War and World War II, and how could people do these things to each other? A very similar journey in some ways that I have made in the last 10 years. And I am seeing the seeds of really disturbing things happening in our society all around the world. And I'm wondering if you have an answer to understand it or to diffuse what we seem to be building now.
Well, I can see when I wrote a book in 1999 called Maps of Meaning, which took me about 15 years to write. So I wrote it between 1985 and 1999. And during that time, I was obsessed with the issues that you just described. And the issues for me were, number one, how, and this is in relationship to the Cold War, how is it that the world could be split into two opposing, let's say, ideological camps, or at least two idea-based camps, and that split was manifested itself with such intensity that people on both sides of the divide were willing to put the entire, what would you say, put being itself at risk.
Yes.
To arm ourselves so heavily that we could plausibly destroy everything, and that we might be willing to do that. Why was it that people were so wedded to their beliefs and their opposing beliefs that developed, let's say, even though no one necessarily thought it was a good idea, it obviously developed. And then a secondary question was, how is it that in the service of ideological possession, let's say, people could commit acts of unbelievable brutality, like those that characterized the death camps in Nazi Germany and the Gulag archipelago in the Soviet Union and the absolute mayhem that reigned in Maoist China. I was interested in individual motivation, not the motivation of groups so much, but how and why people could find themselves as individuals in situations where they would be called upon and then commit acts of unimaginable brutality, even when apparently normal in their psychological makeup. So I was trying to delve into those two ideas. The first, in Maps of Meaning, the first thing I wanted to figure out was, in this ideological war between the West and the Soviet Union, let's say, was that merely just a difference of opinion, let's say, as the postmodernists might have it, because postmodernists don't believe that there are any belief systems that have any more fundamental utility or reality than any others. And so I was curious, was it just a matter of opinion? And with the Soviet Union taking the communitarian stance, let's say, and the West taking the capitalist democratic stance, but there was no right or wrong at the bottom of that. It was just a matter of arbitrary power. So I spent a lot of time investigating the understructure of those belief systems, partly as a consequence of reading people like Nietzsche and Carl Jung and Alexander Solzhenitsyn and a variety of others, some very great people. And what I concluded was that this was not merely a matter of opinion, that there was something about the way we constituted our belief systems in the West, predicated as they are on the Judeo-Christian tradition, that being in turn predicated on something even deeper, something of even evolutionary significance, I would say, that made it quite evident to me that the idea of the supremacy of the individual that's emerged in the West is by no means merely another opinion. And the reason for that is twofold, I think. The first is that the state cannot be the answer to our problems because the state is static, as indicated by its very name. The state is static, and it's composed of the contributions of the dead in the past. And no matter how great the dead were, they're dead, and they cannot respond in a vital way to the challenges of the present. The individual has to do that. So even though the state and tradition is necessary, which every conservative, say, would note in a moment, it's the individual that has to serve as the eyes and the voice of the state and revivify it when necessary. And that's part of that rebirth process.
It's very much what you're saying is very similar to almost what Thomas Jefferson wrote about, that we can write it down now, but this will change and should change. And every single generation has to find it for themselves and has to and defend it and live it for themselves. Dead should not rule beyond the grave.
Well, that's it. Well, and, you said that every generation has to rediscover it. There's a motif that I've concentrated on quite extensively in Maps of Meaning, but also in my YouTube lectures, which is the archetypal motif of rescuing the father from the belly of the beast. You see that, for example, one of the popular manifestations of that was in the Pinocchio story that Disney did in the 30s, right, where Pinocchio, to stop being a puppet, has to journey down to the darkest place there is and rescue his father. And that is the responsibility of the living to the past, is that we have to go back. We have to go into chaos, and the chaos, let's say, right now being our current polarized political state, and find out what was wise and good and productive about the past, and then lend it a new voice and new vision. And that makes the individual. The individual who does that is then an optimal combination of that dynamic living vision and voice that's also symbolized, by the way, by the Christian idea of the word and the traditions of the past. And that's the solution. So you said, well, what's the solution to the polarization that is tearing us apart? Well, the polarization is a polarization of group identity, right? It's the left pushes forward an identitarian perspective where group identity is the paramount feature of every individual. And then the right does the same thing. Now, they're doing it for different reasons, but they're driven by the same belief that identification with the group is the highest moral virtue. And I would say that's wrong.
It is.
You have to have respect for the group. You have to have respect for your traditions and gratitude for them rather than pride about them, because you didn't produce them, which is another reason why I think racial pride and even pride in tradition is a very bad idea. Pride is a sin, and it goes before a fall. You be humble. You should be humble and grateful for what the past has given to you. And you should strive to embody the best of it and to revivify it. And you should act as an individual. And I do believe that the path of the divine individual, let's say, is actually the proper redemptive path. And I believe that that's the central message. Well, I think it's the central message of Judaism, especially with regards to the prophetic tradition. But it's most definitely the central message of Christianity, because Christianity puts forward the notion that the individual is, well, partakes of divinity. And one of the things I pointed out in my biblical lectures is that there's an idea in Genesis, which I've studied in depth, that at the beginning of time, God creates order out of chaos with the word. And so the idea there, the psychological idea is that there's something about communicative and productive, honest speech that encounters chaos and the unknown. That's the tohu vabohu that exists at before the beginning of the universe. And that truthful and positive words spoken forth brings order out of chaos, brings habitable order out of chaos. That's the creation story in Genesis. And part of that creation story is the idea that human beings are made in the image of God. And what that means is that we have the capacity and the moral obligation to speak truth, to orient ourselves to the good and speak truth, and to bring habitable order out of chaos. And that's, if we don't do that,
then what?
Then chaos reigns and things deteriorate into hell.
And I think that's where we're headed. Back in just a minute with Dr. Jordan Peterson.
You say that we're headed to
chaos.
Hell.
We are seeing it grow every single day, and it's because we're stifling speech. Dr. Jordan Peterson, psychology professor, University of Toronto. You can find him on YouTube and watch the Pinocchio YouTube. It's remarkable.
Glenn Beck. You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
We are thrilled to have Jordan Peterson on. He is a professor at the University of Toronto and a fearless defender of the truth. You get into a lot of trouble for the things that you say because you don't agree with political correctness at all. And, we're struggling now with a way to tell the truth and not be destroyed by it. Any tips?
Well, the first thing is that, from one perspective, I've got in a lot of trouble, but I would say the net consequence has been overwhelmingly positive in all sorts of ways, both personal and social. But I would also say a lot of it, Glenn, is a matter of having your fears in order. Like, there's no doubt that telling the truth is a risky enterprise. But it's not even in the same category of risky as not telling the truth. Like, the thing is the consequences of telling the truth might be immediate and self-evident, and the consequences of failing to speak the truth, hiding, say, or lying, are deferred and medium to long term. But they're much more grotesque and terrible. I mean, deceit and sins of omission, like failing to say what you really think to be the case, it warps your character and it sets you up for a terrible fall in the future. And so, people have been commending me on my bravery over the last year. And I think in some sense it's misguided, because I'm not so much brave, I think, as terrified of the right thing. And the last thing that I want to do, and this is, I think, partly because of what I realized by analyzing what happened in Nazi Germany and in the Soviet Union and so forth, is the last thing I'm willing to do is to sacrifice my voice, let's say. Like, I'm way more terrified of that than of anything else. Mm. And I just think that, I don't think of that as a metaphysical statement. I think, although it is, I think of it as a practical statement.
Yeah.
If you lose your character because you lose your voice, then, well, As the Pinocchio movie puts it, you become a brain jackass, a puppet. You stay a puppet and become a brain jackass. And that's a really bad idea. You end up sold to the salt mines when that happens. It's not a good thing.
Jordan Peterson, he is coming out with a new book in January, and I'd love to have him back. 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. We're going to continue our conversation with him in just a second. You can find him online and YouTube. Just Google search Jordan Peterson, Dr. Jordan Peterson. And I think you will spend the day really hearing the truth, I think, refreshingly for the first time.
Glenn Beck. This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
The guy I want you to get to know, his name is Jordan B. Peterson. JordanBPeterson.com is his web address. You can just find him. He is on YouTube. He's written several books. He's got a new one coming out in January, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. Professor, I'm glad to have you on, and maybe you can help us find some meaning or a direction to go here. Both sides here in America, I'm sure you're aware of what's happening here in America. It's gotten a little nuts.
It's the same in Canada.
Is it?
You guys, oh yes, it's very bad.
We're sitting here now arguing over fake news, and it's amazing if you're somebody who just doesn't have a side, your side is the truth. You're looking at both sides saying you're both lying and you're both telling the truth. It just depends on when and where. And most people don't have a way to find the truth, or at least they're willing just to go with whatever is on their side. And so the truth is kind of everywhere and yet nowhere in America. How do you find the truth? How do you know what truth is?
Well, the first thing I would say is that you have to be very careful if when making a claim that you can find the truth or that you know what the truth is. But the question can still be answered. And I would say the way to start allying yourself with the truth, which is a good idea, by the way, because the truth reflects reality, and it's good to have reality on your side since there's a lot of it and not very much of you. The first thing you do is restrict falsehood. And so I would say that if people are interested in telling the truth and abiding by the truth, which is the most practical thing you can do, that the first thing you do is to stop lying. And you can tell when you're lying. You can do that by omission, you know, by failing to say something you believe to be true, or by commission, by actually being deceitful. You can tell if you're doing that because it makes you weak. It makes you feel physically weak and ashamed. And everyone knows that. That's the voice of conscience. And we because we're imaginative and because we can distort and manipulate our perceptions and our language, we're very tempted to live out falsehoods and to perceive falsehoods. You have to start humbly, sort of in your own, well, there's this advice I've been giving to people that's become somewhat of an internet meme, which is, I think someone just sent me 50 bumper stickers with this on it. I've been telling people to clean their rooms, you know, because one of the things I've noticed with the college type activists is that they're very frequently young people who have no control whatsoever over their own personal life. Everything about them is in disarray. And yet they're possessed by the idea that they can critique the general social structure and that they have the wisdom to put it right. It's like you should attend to your own mistruths to begin with in your own personal life, in your own family, and get that straight. It's very difficult. That's why it says in the New Testament that you should remove the beam of wood from your eye before you worry about the dust mote in your neighbor's eye. That's a very wise statement, and it's not one that people like to hear because, you know, when we want to come out for the truth, we want to do it in a grand gesture so that everyone notices. But to come out for the truth is something that you do humbly and privately and even with a certain degree of embarrassment and shame, because you become aware very rapidly of how many petty and terrible ways you're distorting your relationship with reality. It's embarrassing.
But I don't know if people are embarrassed by, I mean, there are people who, you know, you've gotten in trouble with them that will look you straight in the eye and say, there is no biological difference between a man and a woman. Well, that is just,
well, I don't know if they'll look me straight in the eye and say that, you know what I mean? And I don't, My experience has been in situations like that, that words of that form are not put forward with any strength. And one of the things that's happened to me, Glenn, in the last year that's been extraordinarily interesting, and I'm unbelievably fortunate that it's occurred, is that every time I've been attacked by people who are putting forward the kind of ideology that you've been describing. It has backfired unbelievably spectacularly. And so these untruths, let's say, they reveal themselves in people's gestures and attitudes. They make people resentful and vengeful. That's the worst of it. But they also deprive their words of any real strength, which is partly why they have to be put forward with such vehemence and force and ideological exactitude, because there's nothing really behind them. And well, that becomes quite evident. Well, that becomes quite evident in the course of a genuine public discussion.
What does it mean to be a Christian anymore?
I mean, what it should mean is, and I'm speaking psychologically again here, let's say, I mean, Christ is the archetypal perfect man, whatever that means. It's a concept that's really beyond understanding, because we don't know our full extension. We don't know our full possibility or potentiality. I mean, Christ himself said that the people that he left behind could do works greater than his if they were willing to undertake the arduous pathway necessary to make that occur. So there's no underestimating the potential power and grandeur and nobility of the individual. But the problem is that it requires the adoption of infinite responsibility, let's say. You know, one of the things that characterizes Christ, technically speaking, is that he took the sins of the world unto himself. And that can be interpreted psychologically as well. Like when I was reading about Auschwitz, and about the behavior of the camp guards in Auschwitz, I wasn't reading about some evil Nazi who wasn't me doing these things. I was reading about me doing them. And that's a terrible thing to apprehend. And to be a Christian, say, in any real sense, is to understand first that you bear the moral burden of the 20th century. And that it's up to you to do something about it, and not to change other people, but to put yourself together so that if the political situation warped and twisted around and you were called on to do something reprehensible, that you would have the strength of character to refuse to do it. But to even develop that, you have to understand first that you're the person in the concentration camp who's having the, you know, the person who's just been hauled off the rail cars, crammed in there like cattle, lined up and then sentenced to carry a wet sack of salt that weighs 100 pounds from one side of the compound to another and back. And that you're the person who would enjoy doing that to someone in such a terrible situation. Well, that's what it means, at least in part, to be Christian. It means to, first of all, come to terms with the fact that terrible corruption and malevolence of human beings is something that characterizes you, and that you have an obligation to understand that and to work to rectify it. Because the consequence of not doing it is dreadful beyond imagining. And so it's very difficult for people to do that. You know, in Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, there's a little story called The Grand Inquisitor, where Christ comes back to earth and in Seville during the time of the Spanish Inquisition. And he's raising the dead and performing miracles and being a generally good guy and causing a lot of trouble. And the Inquisitor has him arrested and thrown into prison and to be executed. And the Inquisitor tells him that the burden that he's placed on human beings is just too great, and that the church has spent centuries trying to modify his demand so that normal people could tolerate it. You know, and there's really something to that. The burden, the moral burden that's placed on someone who claims to be a Christian is so fundamentally unbearable. But the alternative is worse. So that's where we're at. You either bear the burden and the responsibility of constraining evil in your own heart and then trying to work to make the world a better place, or you exist in the hell that you produce for not doing so.
I'm struck by the fact that courage really is a muscle and misunderstood. it you're not going to be able to rise to the occasion in horrific situations like in the past in the 20th century if you don't rise to the occasion now. If you don't.
Yes, which that's exactly right. Well, which also shows you that what you do right now, day to day, the way you conduct yourself with your husband or wife and at work and with your family, despite the fact that those things are day to day, they're not mundane or trivial. They're vitally important because you put your finger on it precisely. It's that under if you can manifest a good character under normal circumstances, then perhaps you'll have developed the sort of character that will enable you to stand up properly in the midst of a catastrophe. And one of the things that I've been telling the people who've been watching my videos, say, who are overwhelmingly young men, by the way, is that they should strive to be the person who's the most reliable, person at their father's funeral. That's a good goal. That's a goal that it's indicative of the development of some tragic sensibility with regards to life and the formulation of some real character in the face of that tragedy. And then young people now are fed such a diet of pablum. You know, they're told to develop their self-esteem and to be happy and to be free and to follow their impulses wherever they might lead. And it's not nourishing. Young men in particular are dying. I mean, literally, they're dying because of that. They're dying spiritually, and they're dying, well, they're dying in actuality as well, because being human requires a noble mode of being. You can't tolerate yourself if you're weak and deceitful and arrogant and resentful. You just hate yourself, and then you do harm to yourself and to others. It's much better to be called forward to do something noble and courageous. And I've been absolutely struck, Glenn, that the thing that's been most surprising in the last year, I would say, is when I'm doing my public talks, and this was especially evident in this biblical series, which has been packed, by the way. It's sold out every day, every time we've hosted one, which is completely bizarre. But anyways, every time in those public forums where I talk about responsibility and truth to these audiences, mostly of young men, they're on the edge of their seats, man. You can hear a pin drop. It's every time. It's intense. And I think it's because since the mid-60s, no one's taken young people and young men in particular and shook them and said, look, you know, you're not who you could be. Get your act together. You know, stand up. Tell the truth. Take your place in the world. And fortify our culture instead of being whiny and resentful and weak and nihilistic and cowardly and ideologically possessed and immature.
Dr. Jordan Peterson, I don't even feel comfortable anymore calling you by your first name. Dr. Peterson, I have to tell you, I get an opportunity to talk to a lot of amazing people, and I have met some truly great people. This has been, the last 15 minutes has been one of the more remarkable times of my life. You are a man for this time, and I hope to be able to meet you in person sometime, but we will be watching from afar. I thank you for everything that you're doing.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Glenn. Yeah.
I have to go back and find what he said about the resurrection and play it for you, because it was just so honest and so raw and so personal. It's amazing because he said, I don't know what to think. I don't know what to think. You know, my logic tells me no. But everything in me says yes. And obviously a man who, whether he's a Christian or not, boy, seems to exemplify Christianity.
Glenn Beck.
This is the Best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules for Life is his book. I haven't read it yet, but we're just looking through it in the break. And it's a lot of the stuff that we've talked about here. I mean, maybe that's why I like him is, I don't know, maybe he's reinforcing my worldview. And I don't know, maybe I'm falling into that trap.
It's 2017. That's what we all want out of the world.
I know.
People that reinforce your worldview. But I mean, this list of 12 things is fantastic. I mean, compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today.
Just that would change the world.
Oh my gosh. Set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. Fantastic. Pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient. Hard. And then I like this one. Do not bother children while they are skateboarding. Which, yeah, maybe we shouldn't hover as much as we do, I guess, is
maybe
the point of that. I like
maybe
that.
Maybe just a little bit.
Glenn Beck.